books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today's show is a compilation of when Read On was recorded live on stage. On today's show, we've got a climber, an actor, a comedian, and we'll have an author too. All these shows were recorded live in front of an audience, mainly at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. Later on, we'll hear how comedian Juliet Burton became a narrator for RNIB Talking Books. My old compadre Red Sale will be answering questions about his book, The Blind Man of Hoy. And actor John Gordon Sinclair will talk about mixing acting with his writing. But first on today's show, our first live guest is a Booker shortlisted author.
Please welcome my next guest,
Graham McRae Burnett.
Now, Graham, you're no stranger to RNIB Talking Books.
No, I'm not.
Your first book, The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, was recorded there. How did that come about?
So my first book, all my books have been published by a small independent publisher called Saraband Books, until recently were based in Partick in Glasgow and very close neighbours of Connect Radio. So I think Sarah, my publisher, had used or put, was regularly putting forward books for to be recorded. And so it was kind of like neighbourliness in a way. But I think there's a kind of ethos of, as well with Sarah, my publisher, and myself, to want to use people who are local. And so that was the first thing. I think we did an interview for the radio station then. And I've done a book group over the telephone for the RNIB. And we did His Bloody Project up there as well. And I think as well, it's like access to actors with, you know, the right kind of accents and stuff. It's all useful and it's good.
Now, let's take the two books as a whole. There's a distance there. Uh-huh. You know, the first book isn't a book I wrote. This is a book I translated. The second book isn't a book I wrote. It's a book I found. Why is there that arm's length from the reader?
Thanks for starting with such an easy question. I did an event a couple of years ago before His Bloody Project at Shawlands Academy and with some kids of 14 or 15. And one of them asked me almost the same question. It was the first time I'd been asked, you know, why are you hiding behind these other authors? So in the first book, I pretend that I merely translated the novel, and it was the work of this French writer called Raymond Brunet. Brunet being a quite obvious pun of my own name. But strangely to me at the time, a lot of people believed that it was actually a French novel. And sometimes we were a little bit disgruntled by that as if I'd tricked them. And I started to become really interested in that, because when we read a novel, we're always tricking ourselves because we know it's a fiction. But, you know, if the novel works for us, we want to believe that it's real. It has a reality for us. We create pictures in our heads. I don't know how that works if you're visually impaired. I'd be very interested to hear about that. But anyway, I'm avoiding your question. Why do I do that? The short answer is, I don't know. I've got a kind of brainy answer about Roland Barthes and the death of the author, and how I think that the important relationship is the relationship between the reader and the book, not the relationship between the author and the book. And, you know, very often, especially if you're studying books at school, the question that your teachers tend to ask you is, what did the author mean? And to me, it's the least interesting question as a reader. I don't care what the author meant. So I want readers to have their own engagement and take their own meanings, find their own resonance with the book, and it becomes less and less relevant, you know, what the author thought. So I think there is a kind of serious, there's a kind of playfulness about it, but there's a kind of seriousness. I'm kind of saying, you know, you make up, you know, you come to your own conclusions about the book. You know, don't worry about what I thought.
That rabbit hole goes deeper, though, because
I thought this was going to be some light, fluffy event, you know.
The translator's note at the end, which is you wrote, says that it was made into a film in the 60s, and there's a trailer for that film online now.
Well, that's right. That does. As Robert said, the afterword to my first book says that it got made into a film by Claude Chabrol, and this famous French film director is a real person, and this made the book into a sort of cult hit in France. And then I was doing an event. I've got a friend in Glasgow who runs a kind of cult cinema night, so we decided we would show a Claude Chabrol film, and I would do a bit of an introduction and a reading from Adèle Baudot, because it's a very small town atmosphere, and he's a very clever guy with, you know, all these sort of techie gizmos. So he made a sort of pastiche trailer for the Claude Chabrol film that doesn't exist. And it is now, it is there online. Mm. You've obviously been doing your research. And a journalist came across it one time. It was actually David Robinson of The Scotsman. He was interviewing me. And he got very concerned that I was trying to pretend that it was something that it wasn't, or something, or I was being more than mischievous. But it's all these things just came out of, that was a bit of fun, and it's still there. And I've become more and more interested in the questions of why people are concerned that what they're reading is not real, when it's encapsulated. There was a review on Amazon for the first book, and the reviewer seemed to have generally enjoyed the book, but he ended his review with the words, "It's a shame it's all so fake." I'm like, well, yeah, it's a novel. But what he felt was like, the novel was not as it appeared. It was not a real novel. It's a fake novel that is made up. But of course, all novels are fake and made up. And I don't have an answer to all these things. But as you say, it's a kind of rabbit hole, and it all gets racked up with his bloody project, where I claim to have found the documents. Mm. I describe the documents in Anne O'Hanlon in the archive, who helped me. She doesn't exist. The documents don't exist. And then I found this real life character, James Bruce Thompson, the psychiatrist in the book. He is a real person, and he enters my fictional world. So I'll leave it to you to untangle it.
We'll get to his bloody project in a moment, but first of all, an easy one. Tell us about the disappearance of Adèle Baudot.
It's really nice to be asked about it, because I rarely am these days. It's a book. It's set in this small town in France called Saint-Louis, which I visited quite by chance. It's a very unremarkable place, and it's described as an unremarkable place. It's right on the border with Switzerland. And the book came about because I wandered into this town for absolutely no reason whatsoever with a friend. And we went for lunch in a very typical French brasserie, the sort of place where there's a menu du jour. And everybody, the clerical workers, come in for their three-course lunch and a glass of wine. The guys from the building site come in for their three-course lunch. And, you know, the bank manager will be in. And everybody stops and has lunch, and I love that. And these places, there's a sense of timelessness about these places, and there's a great sense of routine that people go there every day. And I was sitting there having my lunch. This was about nearly 16 years ago, and so you can see how rapid a writer I am. And there was a character standing at the counter. He was wearing a suit, and he looked a bit sort of uncomfortable. And there was some men at the table in the corner who seemed more sort of jovial and cheery and enjoying each other's company. And I suppose it's the sort of writerly imagination. I suddenly saw these characters as being people who appeared and came to that restaurant every day for lunch but never spoke to each other, or there would be some unspoken dislike between them. And I wrote a little sketch at the time, just a description of the restaurant and the characters there. And it was 10 or more years later, I came back to that sketch. It just lodged in my head, and I just used that to sort of create the story and allow the characters to... I put an event in, the disappearance of Adèle Baudot, who's a waitress in the brasserie, and she disappears, and that event is just a trigger for everything else that happens in the book. So it's really a character study of this guy that I saw standing at the counter, sort of ill at ease outsider called Manfred Baumann.
The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, the sequel The Accident on the A35, and the Booker shortlisted His Bloody Project are all available from RNIB Talking Books. Another of his books, Case Study, is available in audio commercially, as will be the concluding part of the Gorski trilogy, A Case of Matricide, which comes out in October.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Next up is my old compadre, Red Sail. I interviewed him on stage about his book, The Blind Man of Hoy, the true story of how he became the first blind man to climb the Old Man of Hoy. Red gave a talk, which can be heard in full if you go back in time to episode 30 of Read On. But after the talk, he answered some questions from both myself and the audience.
I'm just curious, did you use your residual vision at all, or was it a purely tactile experience?
Almost entirely tactile. To be honest, your nose is so close to the rock most of the time that the residual central vision that I have is really not much use. The things that I can see tend to be more distant, where the few pixels that I have left in my vision actually can sort of combine into an image. Actually, a lot of the time I was wearing sunglasses as well, just to protect from chips of rock falling off and hitting me in the eye. I did get a halfway decent view when I stood at the top of the madly gesticulating partners in crime at the other side, but they were a good sort of 100 metres distant.
This question has nothing to do with your blindness, because I felt throughout that talk that your being blind was in a way incidental. I mean, it underlines the fantastic nature of what you did. But, you know, you speak in such an inspirational way that one tends to forget that you are blind. I hope you don't mind my saying that. My question is this. When you were climbing the Old Man of Hoy, did you wear gloves? Do climbers in that kind of situation wear gloves, or do you have to be without gloves in order to be able better to feel the crevices and the holds?
No, we don't wear gloves. We just have hands like sandpaper. For me, that's actually part of the joy, is being able to feel rock, which is 650 million years old. It gives you a great sense of perspective of our short time on Earth and the timelessness of the rocks that you climb. And actually, especially with things like sandstone, which the old man is, the friction between skin and rock is sometimes all that's actually keeping you there. So whilst we wear thin leather climbing slippers, which are very tight, a bit like ballet shoes, but slightly tougher on our feet, no, we've got bare hands. And as my wife would tell you, your fingers get really quite messed up. As do your forearms, your elbows, and any other part of your body that you jam into a crack in the rock to try and give you a bit of leverage.
I suppose it really is a very tactile sport in itself.
Part of the reason I think it's a good sport for blind and partially sighted people is because, especially climbing things like sandstone and limestone, these are rocks with big vertical cracks in them. Actually, it's a bit like being a tram. You can follow the line of the crack and usually find a way up the rock. It might not always be the most direct or the easiest route, but there's usually a guideline to follow.
Now, tell us about your relationship with Talking Books.
I think Talking Books is a lifeline. I was an English graduate. I am an English graduate. I've always wanted to write, and as any writer will tell you, you need source material. You need other people's books to help you write, partly for ideas, partly for inspiration, partly just that you might hear something and read something and disagree with it so violently that it makes you want to put finger to keyboard. And I really got very depressed when I started losing the ability to read. A book which would have taken me 2 or 3 days to read was taking me 2 or 3 weeks. And I think next to not being able to see my wife and children, that was actually the bitterest pill that I had to swallow. So without talking books, I wouldn't have a doorway into the library that I love. And I would feel far more isolated than my blindness actually makes me feel anyway.
And I know the answer to this. You would say you're a heavy user.
I'm a very heavy user. I'm on about 2 books a week, mate. I mean, it's great. I can do the ironing and the cooking and listen to an audiobook. I could never do that with a paperback in one hand. I probably am reading far more than I ever used to.
I loved when I spoke to you before, you talked about a glitch in the system where you would get random books.
Yeah, I've had some brilliant random books. I've got Lord knows where they came from. But, you know, books that I would never have sat down and, picked off the shelf myself. I think it was Sunlight Over the Chimneys or something, which was a brilliant book about a woman who became wheelchair-bound when she was about 10 years old, and her awful life in the Goebbels, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, in Glasgow. And it was just the most thoroughly life-affirming book, and it was exactly the kind of title that I just would never have gone for otherwise. So, yeah, no, I love the glitch in the system. It's not quite as present in Overdrive, but then again, I have climber's fingers, so every so often I'll just hit download on the wrong book. So
now, Blind Man of Hoyt is in production at the moment in Braille and giant print and in audio. Available now is your first book, Blind Trust. Tell us about that.
It's the book I always wanted to write. It's about a house husband called Joe Wind, who's living in North London, who, when his friend commits suicide, sees the crime that the police have missed, and there's a domestic conspiracy going on in the area that he lives in, and he and his next door neighbour Miranda go to investigate it, and it leads them down some very dark, winding, cobbly paths. And I won't say any more because I don't want to wreck it, but it's the book that I was composing as a house husband looking after my little kids. And then when they went to primary school, I had the time to start typing away. And it also coincided with the time that actually I was unable to read anymore. And so I thought, well, if I can't read, I'll write. And fortunately, that was before I discovered talking books. So I had the time to do it. And it was fortunate enough to find a publisher, and then even better, it was picked up by RNIB Talking Books, and I got a lovely email last week from the Talking Books service in New Zealand asking for permission if they could do it for their own audience out there. So clearly it's found an audience, which is great. Now I just have to get the sequel done. I have to stop climbing.
What was easier, fact or fiction?
That's a really difficult question. Fact is easier because the plot is already there. Mm. And as I said in my talk, the plot of The Blind Man of Hoy is just that classic trajectory of any thriller. Basically, you have the only way to write fiction is to start out with a synopsis and stick very closely to that plot. You just start hanging flesh off the bones, and that's quite a tough discipline to stick to sometimes, because your imagination takes you off in other ways, and you can quite easily be seduced by an idea or a sentence. So the trouble with the fact is that you've actually, in my case, you've just got to go out and live it as well. So there's a lot of keeping fit and climbing. The next book will be fiction. I'm planning another adventure, but what comes out of that, we'll see.
Any more questions from the audience?
My name's Phil Sawbridge. Just to say that having read your book with enormous enjoyment and now having heard you with even more enjoyment, having cancelled something else in the festival in order to come and hear you, I'd like to thank you for that. And I wonder if you could tell us what other climbs either there have been or there may yet be.
Thank you, Phil. And well, thank you for coming along to this rather than the other event. I hope the other author doesn't catch up with you. There are three big sea stacks, as you probably know, in Scotland. I came back the year afterwards to climb the Blind Man of Stour, which was a great climb, a bit windy, but great fun. And then last year I came up again to Sandwood Bay to tackle the third of the three, Bukele. Unfortunately, the weather was against us with 2 meter high waves and 60 mile an hour horizontal winds. So that would have made the swim out there a little bit tricky. So I've got unfinished business. So I'll be coming back to hopefully to knock that one off next year. I'm very keen on having a go at Kilt Rock on Skye. And then in a couple of years' time, I'd like to go out to Pabeg and climb the Great Arch out there. I just need to make sure that my children have something else to do over the summer holiday whilst I disappear for a couple of weeks to hang out with a bunch of climbers and mess around on rock. I'm also quite tempted to go out and do some stuff in the Alps, but I'm still trying to persuade my wife that this is a good idea. And but we'll see. Before that, I'll be heading out to Sardinia with my climbing partner, Matthew, hopefully in October, to mess around on the limestone out there and put some grazers on my hands.
And in case you don't know, since that talk, Red has become the first blind person to climb Scotland's big three sea stacks: the Old Man of Hoy, the Old Man of Stour, and most recently, Ambuckle.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The very first books in the studios were recorded on wax disc.
Of course, recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake, and they were really adept at covering over mistakes, apparently. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy, who used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake, he just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing is, you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And next on today's show, let's join John Gordon Sinclair on stage. We were at an event for RNIB Talking Books at the Edinburgh Festival, where I asked him about his second book, Blood Whispers.
Well, it's the follow-up to my first book, was called 70x7, which was set in the early 90s. And this is a kind of follow-up to it, a very loose follow-up to it. There's a minor character in the first book called Kira Lynch, who is trying to escape from her past, and her mother and grandmother bring her over to live in Glasgow, or they did in the early 90s, and she is now, the Blood Whisperers are set in the present day, and she's living in Glasgow, and she's a lawyer. She works as a criminal lawyer. The events, things that have happened to her, if you read the first book, you'll understand what happened to her when she was younger, when she was an eight-year-old kid. And it informs who she is, who her character is, and why she's become a lawyer and trying to help people. Now, but you don't have to have read the first book.
Yeah, I asked you that before. You don't have to have read the first book to enjoy the second one. It's standalone.
It's a standalone book, really. And she's a lawyer. She gets involved with this young girl who's been trafficked into the country and working as a prostitute. And in her dealings with her, she becomes involved with the Serbian mafia. She gets involved with the CIA. And her life kind of spirals out of control. Mm.
I will warn you, though, reading the second one will make you want to read the first one.
Oh, well, that's a good thing. Thank you for that. So that's a brief outline. That's a very brief outline of the book.
Your background is acting. Do you think that helped with the cinematic feel of the book?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm here. We'll probably come on to that, and you're going to ask me this, but now that you've brought that up, it's one of the reasons I'm here actually today, because when I was asked about this and doing the thing for the Royal National Institute, it started raising questions in my mind, because when I write a book, what I'm trying to do is describe a film that's going on in my head. It's a very, for me, it's a very visual process, mm-hmm. you know, and so when I was asked to do this, it made me start asking questions about how, because one of the things I'm not very good at, one of the things I don't like, is lots of descriptions of, you know, scenery and what's going on. I'm not very good at it, mm-hmm. so I prefer to spend my time telling the story through dialogue. And one of the aims I have eventually, if I ever get the chance, is to actually write a book that's kind of more or less all dialogue, and you learn the whole story through the dialogue. But when I'm writing the book, all I'm trying to do is describe the film that's going on in my head. And so I thought, actually, when I was asked to do this, I thought, well, that's kind of really interesting. I'd like to find out how, if there's a way of making that better for people who, if you can't see the image, is there a way, as a writer, I can make that better? If there's a way that I can improve that? So I'm actually here hoping to get some tips, get some hints and tips.
Same, was the first chapter a sort of experiment in that, because that is all dialogue?
Well, the first the book kicks off with a conversation between you find out that she's the main character later on, but it starts off with a conversation between a woman and a psychiatrist, and it is just all dialogue. And yeah, it kind of was not so much an experiment, but I just thought there's no point. You very quickly get the image that what's going on, what this conversation's all about, really. So I thought I don't need to sit down and describe a psychiatrist's chair or a psychiatrist's room, or you know, you get the way they talk to each other, you get that pretty quickly. So I did try to, as far as possible, just to have that chapter as a conversation.
It's quite visceral. Do you think people were expecting that from you in particular, knowing the sort of characters you've played before?
No. I think most people would have expected me to write a light-hearted comedy, really. But that's because most people, when first impressions count, and most people's first impression of me was as a kind of gangling 18-year-old, which was 30 years ago. Well, maybe a bit more than that, actually, but let's stick with 30 for the moment. That's definitely one side of me, but it's not all of me, really. What I wanted to do was write the kind of book that I would want to take on holiday with me. And because it's a crime novel, I thought you can't come at a crime novel and make it funny. You know, it's got, if there's, because a few people have commented, particularly in the first one, the second one not so much, but a few people have commented on the kind of level of violence in the first book. But it's only one aspect of it, because for me the violence in the first book is the same as the humour in the first book, or the if you're supposed to empathise with someone. My whole thing is that if a scene's supposed to be funny, then I hope you laugh. If it's supposed to be sad, I hope you cry. If it's supposed to be violent, I hope you think, oh, actually that's too much. I don't really like that, because for me violence is like that. And similarly in the second book, it's probably the second book it's a female protagonist who's the main, she's the main character. And so if there were scenes where violence was involved, I thought, I was thinking, well, how would, from a female perspective, how would this pan out, really? So it's possibly not quite as violent as the first one. But again, and here's me, I'm now talking myself into making it sound like it's really violent. It's not. As I say, if it's funny, I hope you laugh. If it's sad, I hope you cry.
I was going to give a spoiler away about weapons she uses, but I won't.
Yes, well... when I first wrote the book, it just so happened at the time that I was reading a book by Cormac McCarthy, which I don't know if anyone's read it. It's unremittingly violent. It's horrible. Mm. And I got halfway through it and I couldn't... I actually put it down and thought, I can't finish this, it's too much. But with any book that I've ever read, I don't like doing that. I want to kind of get to the end, even if I don't enjoy it. But at least I can say I finished it. I read an interview with Cormac McCarthy where he said that he wanted to write a book that made people feel what real violence feels like. So that it's not there just as an entertainment, it's there. He wanted to get closer to how real violence feels. And when I read that, I thought it made me go back and redo some scenes in the first book. Because I thought, actually, I do want... If people read that and think, this is too much, I want to flick on to the next page, they won't miss anything in the storyline, but the effect of the violence, it will have had that effect on them. It will make them feel like, I don't really like that. Because I think you shouldn't enjoy violence, really.
Is there...
Can we get off the violence?
Okay.
I feel like I've said violence about 500 times.
But is there a third on the way? A third book?
Yes, there is. Well, it's not on the way yet, but there is. Yeah, we haven't quite done the deal yet, but there's been an offer made for the third book,
right?
Which I'm quite pleased about. Actually, the second book, there's a lot of loose ends at the end of the second book, and I thought at the time when I sent it off to the publishers, I thought if they phone me back and say, look, you've got to tie off these loose ends, then I'll know that I'm not getting a deal for a third book. But if nobody calls me, then there's a chance that there's a possibility that they might want another one. So I was quite pleased when nobody phoned me.
Now, you mentioned publishers. Was it quite easy to get the first book published just because of who you are?
Well, a lot of people think that, actually, but in actual fact, it made it a little bit harder. The head of paperbacks at Faber, at the launch that we had for the book, she stood up and made this speech, which was quite funny because... she started saying when the book first came in, she was saying, I don't want to read that. It's that actor, John Gordon Sinclair, and, it's going to be terrible. And at the time, I remember when she was at the launch, I was thinking, I'm actually standing here. Why are you telling this story? It was the editor, a younger editor who had no idea of, had never seen me acting or anything like that. She was reading it purely on the fact that, it was a novel that had been sent into her, and it was her that persuaded her to actually the head of paperbacks to actually read it. So it was a close run thing, it actually almost got in the way, really.
Now you've recently been in World War Z. At the end of World War Z, excuse me for a minute, did your character live?
No, unfortunately, just after I was killed, they announced they were going to do a sequel.
So I never actually saw him being killed.
No, he just walks off the end of the end of the plane, and they'd used the budget up by that point.
Right, okay.
but I remember when I first got the call about World War Z and thinking, why? Because you get a onesie. I was thinking, a World War Z? I wonder what a World War Z is. Because I hadn't, and then someone said, no, that's the American pronunciation of Z. And I'm like, all right, okay, I get you now. I hadn't quite... Because I hadn't seen it written down or anything like that. I just got a phone call saying, we want to go along for this meeting for World War Z. I'm going, really? Okay.
Some of which was filmed in Glasgow, but you weren't in any of the Glasgow scenes?
No, I did. I did 5 weeks on it in total, and they did 7 weeks in the UK. And the 2 weeks that I wasn't involved in were the 2 weeks that they were filming in Glasgow. And everyone in Glasgow was saying, I thought you said you were in this. I said, I'm just not in that bit. And they're saying, you're just pulling a leg. You're not in it at all.
Now, from a member of a SWAT team to you're now playing Jeeves on stage.
I'm in the West End just now in London doing Jeeves and Wooster. Yeah, and I'm playing Jeeves. With an English accent, because the first question everyone says to me is, "Oh, is this the first Scottish Jeeves?" And I get a bit shirty and say, no, I am actually an actor. Do you know what I mean? I can do voices. They're not very good, but I can do them.
Now, would you say you were an actor or a writer?
I'm much more a writer. If I had the choice, if someone said to me, you can choose one or the other and never do it t'other again, I would choose writing. And my personality is much more suited to being a writer. I'm not... I'm a bit of a sociophobe, really. I'm not very... I'm generally not that happy. I'm much happier sitting in my hut at the bottom of the garden plotting ways to kill people than I am actually going to parties and standing on stage making people laugh. So
you'd rather be in your hut right now?
I'd rather be... Well, not right now, obviously, but no, I'm not... I'm much more... I'd much rather be a writer, yeah.
Now, my last question, if they made Blood Whispers into a movie, what part would you play in that? You need to have a part in it.
I kind of like to do the Hitchcock thing and just walk through the back of a shot or something like that. I wouldn't really like to be involved in it, really. Because originally, the first book I actually... The first 70x7 was originally going to be a film script. Mm. And it was an idea that I'd had to do something with. People kept mistaking me for Tim Robbins, the actor, for some reason. I kept... and I was going to write a story about mistaken identity and stuff, and it evolved into becoming the novel, really. But from that point onwards, once I started writing it, people keep saying, well, what part would you have? I say I don't really want a part in it. It's not me at all. And similarly with Blood Whispers, there's not really I'd like to just walk through the back of a shot. I think
now we'll have some questions from the audience. Who's got a question?
Could I ask, when you develop the plot, do you have it completely plotted at the start, so you know exactly what you're doing?
No, I did. But the first one, I had a much better idea of where I was going with it. And I actually wrote a different ending to the first book. When I got there, I actually thought, I can't end it. I'd written the Hollywood ending. I don't want to ruin anyone's if you haven't read it before, but when I got there, I thought I can't actually do that. I'm going to have to be a bit more honest with it, and so I changed the ending. And then the idea I had for the second book, once I started writing it, it kind of veered off in a whole entirely different direction, and I ended up, when I'd finished it, I thought I've actually still got that book to write, which is now going to be the third book. So the simple answer to your question is no. I've got no idea, and it's a great thing actually. It's a great thing to experience, because you think you've got one idea in your head, but as it evolves, it changes and morphs into something else. And that when I started doing that, it's a great process to go through. So no, I don't. I've got a rough idea of where this third book is going to go, but I'm kind of hoping that once I start writing it, it will start taking on its own life, really.
Do you ever surprise yourself when you're writing, thinking, I didn't think that was going to happen?
There's quite a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two biggest things for me were, though, there's some stuff that happens at the end of the first book, and when I was writing it, I started crying. And that's a weird thing, because it's in my head, and yet I'm making myself cry. But more weird than that was, I was writing a line that I knew was going to be a punchline, and when I wrote it down, I started laughing. And so I thought, so I've actually just told myself a joke, which I'd love to sit down with a psychiatrist or psychologist or something and explain that to me, because I know the punchline, because it's me that's writing it. But then to read it and start laughing is a very strange experience. Especially when you're sitting in a hut on your own with nobody else around, and you're either weeping or laughing at your own stuff. Weird.
Is this hut within earshot of anyone?
No, thankfully no. No, thankfully not.
Any more questions?
How do you combine your acting career with your writing? Does this mean that you're stuck in your hut at the bottom of the garden for yonks? How long does it take if you're doing you're learning your lines, but you're also sitting
writing.
And you're doing your writing.
Well, I know from very recent experience about this, because the deal for the third book coincided with the restart of rehearsals for the show in the West End. So I was supposed to start writing the third book in July, but that whole month was taken up with rehearsals. And the show is so exhausting that and my kids have just broken up for school, so I've got them during the day, and then I'm doing the show at night, and the rest of the time I'm trying to sleep. So at the moment there's no writing being done. I'm supposed to have started, but it's not going to happen really now until September. So it's a little bit difficult. But what I'm hoping to do is eventually tip the balance. At the moment it's kind of 50-50. There's, you know, 50% acting, 50% writing. But I'm hoping to tip the balance more over the years, the next couple of years, more in favour of just doing the writing. So hopefully that wouldn't be such a concern. But I had a couple of moments when I was rehearsing where I was, it's the closest I've ever come to it, to actually, I thought, I'm going to have to tell them I need to leave now. Because I kept thinking about the book, and thinking that's a good idea for the book. And so I was on stage thinking I might have to just say to them, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be here. I should never have accepted this job. So if you don't mind, I'm going to leave. And I had a real struggle inside my head not to do that.
In a West End production like that, say you're 3 or 4 months into it and you're doing the same thing every night and twice on a Saturday, does it get monotonous?
It can do. I mean, this is the I'm used to doing a year's run in the West End. Over the last 30 years, I got asked quite a lot in Scotland, especially when I come up to Scotland, people say to me, have you given up acting? And I think, well, the last 30 years, I spent 10 of them doing shows in the West End. And because you're not on television, people just assume that you're not doing it. So I'm used to doing year-long runs. And this run that I'm doing just now is only 3 months. So for me, this is like a walk in the park. Mm. We've been doing it for about 8 weeks now. I haven't had that feeling. But when you're doing a year-long run, there can be nights where there's words coming out of your mouth, but actually you're doing your shopping in your head. You're like, I need to go to Tesco's after this and get some cornflakes, you know.
Again, with the writing and acting, if you had to choose stage or screen, what one would you prefer?
I don't know. I think I'd put them level pegging. Once you get up and running in a play, it's a difficult birth doing when you start a play, but once you get up and running, once you hit cruising altitude, it's quite straightforward. I quite like it, but I much prefer the precision of filming and the attention to detail, and that's what I try to put in my books as well, is try and get an attention to detail in there. So I much prefer that way of working. So, but level pegging, I would think.
Any more questions?
Do you like to write on a laptop or computer, or do you prefer to write longhand?
Definitely on a computer. I like the immediacy of it, because you can write something down and then 10 minutes later go back and alter it and change it, and it's much more easy to manipulate. But when I have ideas, I've got everything from cigarette packets to envelopes to toilet paper to the places you suddenly have an idea, you think, I've got to write that down and I'll forget it. But when I'm doing the main bulk of the writing, it's on a computer.
Is it a good or a bad thing that computer's connected to the internet?
Well, I actually find it quite good, because the access you have now with Google and Wikipedia and all these things, the access you have to information is instant, and I like that. You know, if there's so many ideas, I'm never lost for it. Or if I ever am lost for an idea, I just click onto Wikipedia, read something, or click onto Google and search something. And there's so many ideas out there that I quite like the immediacy of that.
Did you use Google Translate for the note?
Which
you need to apologise to the narrator for.
No, I actually... there was a proofreader who went through all that and did the proper translation for it. But I think I might have used Google Translate initially, but then it was corrected.
Is Trish here? The narrator, you had to learn, is it Serbian?
Albanian,
yeah.
Albanian, all right. So have you done it already? Have you actually done the book? Right, good. Well, do you know the funny thing is, I'm so glad it's in a female voice, because it was one of the things I was going to ask, because I didn't realise it'd actually been recorded, and it was one of the things I was going to ask today, was, is there any chance it could be in a female voice? So that's, that's fantastic news. Just put a smile on my face.
But say sorry about the Serbian.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. But you know the thing that will come to you just in 2 seconds. Just on the weird thing, the very first time I came to Edinburgh, not Edinburgh, but to the book festival, was a couple of years ago for the first with the first book, and I was asked to read from the book, and it was the strangest experience, because I kept saying to the publisher, "Well, I need to read," and they said, "No, it's fine, you don't have to." And then obviously when I arrived here, they said, "Right, what bit are you going to read?" I said, "Really? I thought, I'm sure you said I didn't have to," It's the first time it ever struck me, because when I tried to do it, I realised that it wasn't in my voice, and it was a very, very odd thing. And now I don't like actually doing it. And the same with Blood Whispers, because they said, "Would you mind doing, you know, a reading for it?" I said, "It sounds odd, but I actually can't. It's not my voice. It needs to be." I was hoping it would be a female. So that's brilliant.
I was just wondering whether you think that in literature in general, people. Disabilities or minorities are well represented, and whether it's difficult to write about people in those communities.
Well, I suppose it's one of the issues that came up when I was asked about this, because it's something that never really occurred to me before, and that's why I thought, I'm hoping when I get here today I'll learn something from it, you know, because I started looking through to see, you know, about characters in literature who were blind, or and you know, it's there's, you know, the parables and stuff going into the Bible, but there's not really any. It was quite hard to find, you know, people represented in that way. So it's kind of got me thinking, really, and it's also, as I said earlier, it's got me thinking about what things I can do in my writing to make, because for me it's such a visual image, is how to make that better for someone who can't see the image, you know, or so it's kind of got me thinking about it quite deeply, really.
So it's important to you that your books are available in audio and
absolutely brain. Access. I was taken to the opera, and I say I was taken because the tickets were £150 each. And thank God I wasn't paying, because when I saw the price on the ticket, I just happened to glance at the ticket. Nobody had told me this, and I thought, this is absolutely. I suddenly felt really uncomfortable. I thought, this is kind of almost obscene that this costs that amount of money. And I remember reading about the guy who invented. I was thinking, the reason this is such an elitist thing is because most people can't afford it. And I remember reading about the guy that started Penguin Books, and his whole thing was he was in a train station, and all that was available were kind of cheap magazines and crappy paperbacks, and that inspired him to think, well, surely great literature should be available as well. And he started Penguin Books, and their main kind of idea was to get good literature into paperbacks and make it accessible for everyone. And I feel that's the same. Culture, art, it's what defines us as human beings. It's what makes us special, and everyone should have access to that, no matter what, really. So I think it's really important.
You mentioned your ambition was to write a book that's mainly dialogue.
Yeah.
I wonder if you're influenced by Elmore Leonard, who's the king of dialogue, of course, in Crime Thrillers.
Yeah, hugely. And in fact, sometimes when I get stuck for ways to describe things, I glance at an Elmore Leonard book. Don't tell anyone that, in case someone actually points out the actual bits. But yeah, each book, in the first one, there's a couple of guys, there's a couple of characters in Alabama, a couple of criminals who met. I was trying to find somewhere where these two guys would have got together, and it just so happened, as I was searching around Google, I found this place called the Elmore Correctional Center in Alabama, which was a little nod to Elmore Leonard. And one of the guys who leaves Ireland to go to America is travelling on a false passport, and his name on the passport is Mr. Leonard. So I've got Elmore Correctional Center, and I've got him travelling on a passport that's Mr. Leonard. And in the second book, in Blood Whispers, there's a cop in it called, I can't remember what his second name is, Matt, what's his second name? But he was a sergeant in one of the Elmore Leonard books, and he's now a detective, DCI, in my book. So which is another kind of nod to Elmore Leonard. And each, I'm hoping that every book I write will just have a little... If you're an Elmore Leonard fan, you'll find something in there that tips the nod to him.
Now, finally, why are you here supporting RNIB?
Well, I think for the reasons I've outlined, I think everyone should have access to everything that's available, music, writing, you know, film, anything that's out there should be available. And so I was kind of rather thrilled to be asked, and also to challenge my own perceptions as well, to suddenly look into something that I didn't really know a great deal about. You know, I know, just on a very small personal level, because in the last 5 or 6 years I've had to start using reading glasses to read, and what you said earlier on about, I know how important that is to me, and I'm aware that these changes are happening outside with my control, within my body and stuff like that. And so it just, when I got asked about it, it just kind of touched a little nerve in a funny way. So I'm very pleased to be here.
Fantastic. John Gordon Sinclair, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, on today's show, let's get some light relief with comedian and Talking Books narrator, Juliet Burton.
And please welcome our next guest, Juliet Burton.
Hello.
Hello. Now, Juliet, you are a Talking Books narrator.
I am.
How did you get into Talking Books narration?
I got into Talking Books narration because I kind of started off doing quite a few voiceover jobs. That was one of my first things I did as an actor, and kind of did lots of language tapes for people learning English as a foreign language. And then I randomly started working with a lot of... varying disabled people with lots of various disabilities, and one of them is from Abnormally Funny People, who actually have a show on at the Stand in the Square, Simon Minty, and I perform with them now. But back then, they do a podcast, Abnormally Funny People, and I'm a comedian as well as many other things, and I perform comedy that kind of tries to break down barriers about mental health, because I've been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, and I've got lots of conditions that I've been diagnosed with. Anyway, I did a podcast with them, and it happened to be at the RNIB Camden studios. And I was kind of chatting to them about, oh, how can I get into it? And I put my name forward and said, could I please audition? I would really love to audition to be involved. And I did audition. They liked me. And now I do a lot of books for them. And the reason I wanted to audition more than anything was because of my grandmother. My grandmother was one of the most incredible women. She died in 2012, and she at age 96, brilliant, and I hope I take after her in lots of ways. And she became partially sighted in her, I think, over the last 10 years of her life. And she was so intelligent throughout her and all of her life, loved reading. She was passionate about reading and learning more, as much as she possibly could, about the world. And of course, in these last 10 years, she relied heavily on audiobooks. And every Friday, my mum would go off and do her ritual of kind of doing the supermarket shopping and going to visit Granny and getting her hair done and taking Granny her new audiobooks. And Granny would read them so quickly that new ones had to be shipped in from across the country to try and satiate her passion for for reading. And I realised how she lived alone, and she was very independent, even though she was partially sighted and right up to the end of her life. And those books were a lifeline to her. She could continue learning and being entertained. And I just always imagined her kind of being alone at home listening to these voices, and it's a very intimate, very personal thing, and those voices almost become like a friend in some way, I think.
Is that in your head when you are narrating?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've narrated some fantastically fun books, some very interesting ones as well. Yeah. And I always imagine there's going to be the one person listening to my voice for 9 hours, probably not in one go, that might be long, and yeah, I think the longest book I think was nearly 20 hours that I've done recorded, and yeah, I just always imagine them kind of sitting there and hopefully being gripped by the story and caring about the characters, and it's just me and them really in our little world. So I love doing it. It's one of the best things and it's so much fun, and I don't have to wear makeup for it. It's great.
And what sort of books do you narrate now?
Robert and I are giggling because I've done quite a few different things. I've done some young adult fiction, so sort of, and I did a thriller. I've done sort of teenagery kind of things with like witches and sort of preteen chick lit in a way as well. But recently, I've been given quite a few erotica titles. I was given a Mills and Boone to do, so to speak, which was, I learnt a lot. And I've got my next one right here, which I'm doing in September, on the 14th and 15th of September. I'm recording Dark Obsession. I think, would you like me to read?
Yeah, and the voice you'll use for that book.
Are you ready? Right, hold on to your gussets. Lord James is spending an unusual amount of time in the stables while his idle son shows little interest in anything save his stepsister, Tanya. Meanwhile, Lady Marina is harbouring dark secrets of her own. Annabelle is drawn into a world of decadence where anything is allowed as long as a respectable appearance prevails. In an atmosphere of intensity and sexual secrecy, she becomes involved in a variety of interesting situations.
And that's about the only bit we could read out on radio.
Yeah. I actually use this book in my stand-up routine now because there's a page which...
you can't read.
I'm not going to read it, but there's some words on here that are just... They're just so wonderful that I get to... provide a service, I think, to people who are listening to these books and needing a bit of excitement in their lives. And yeah, it's very intimate.
And again, there's a serious side to that because you can get any kind of book you want out of RNIB's library. There's no censorship, no discrimination. If you want Postman Pat, you can get Postman Pat. If you want Dark Obsessions, you can have some Dark Obsessions.
I'm now imagining a combination of the two. That would be an interesting read.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.